here with Nav Kapoor from Manchester, who gave a keynote here at the conference in Derry. Hi, Nav. How are you doing?
I'm really good. How are you, Andre?
I'm great. And it's almost... Well, I think we're just over halfway through, yeah. But I still have some energy left. So
good, good.
Power on now.
Yeah, no, that's great.
So you talked a lot about implementation.
Yeah.
And there's a load of research being presented here, but yeah. You said, no, I'm going to talk about the yeah. problem getting it in.
Absolutely. And I think... what I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of challenge the people here. There's been brilliant research presented here over the last couple of days, more brilliant research to come. But it was really getting people to think about how their research makes a difference. So it's one thing publishing it in journals. It's, how do you, what happens next with your research? How do you get it into practice? How do you get it into guidelines? So quite a lot of my stuff was focused around guidelines, clinical practice guidelines, social care guidelines, which I've been involved in through some of my work with NICE.
Let's just pick up on that, because when I started working in mental health 20 years ago, we said, wouldn't it be great if we had evidence-based guidelines?
Yeah.
And I was involved in publishing one of the first evidence-based guidelines with John Geddes in psychiatry,
yeah.
It was like 1999 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we've got NICE, we've got a lot of evidence-based guidelines, we've got loads of systematic reviews, we've got loads of great research in mental health. But we haven't closed this implementation gap. And we've got mobile phones as well to do it. So what is the... Are guidelines actually useful? Are they going to impact positively on practice?
I'm a big fan of guidelines. I've been involved in guidelines for about 15 years, slightly less time than you. But I think they're really important kind of galvanising force to highlight an issue. And also, people kind of say to me, Nav, why have you done so much of the guideline stuff? Why do you like guidelines? And the stock answer I give is, well, it as a psychiatrist, it gives me the opportunity to affect the care not just of the service user or patient in front of me, but the care for everyone. And it's in some sense you might say, oh, is that a bit trite? It's a bit of a kind of answer, but it's true. I mean, I really am a great enthusiast of guidelines, but I think it's a bit more nuanced than that. I think we need to understand guidelines and their limitations and understand how we best implement them. And that implementation is really important. So, one of the things that I think, generated quite a lot of interest and we talked extensively about is how we actually develop a guideline. People, and you're absolutely right, the big advance has been that the guidelines are evidence-based. So at NICE and other places, we'll look at the research evidence. We'll particularly look at randomised controlled trials. Some people think that's maybe the wrong approach. Other people think, well, it's the best way of evaluating interventions. That's NICE's approach. They prioritise randomised controlled trials for clinical guidelines. And there's definitely that hard science bit in guidelines. And that, I think, is a massive strength. I think the other bit of guidelines is actually perhaps less well known. It's more of a kind of dark art. There's this idea when, well, what do you do? If I'm a clinician and there's no evidence in an area, I still need guidance. So how do you do that? Well, NICE have what we call a kind of consensus-based approach, where the people on the guideline committee, come to a consensus about the best way forward. And sometimes, I've been both a guideline member and a guideline chair, and achieving that consensus is sometimes a bit of a challenge. Sometimes you can have formal consensus-based approaches where you have votes, but in general, NICE don't do that. It's about bringing members of the committee with you or arguing your point. And my experience with guidelines today has been a very positive one, and generally we've got that consensus where the evidence isn't there. But in that context, we have to understand their limitations. These are partly evidence-based, and when the evidence is strong, when the research is good, there's some suggestion that improves implementation. Some of the more consensus-based stuff might be more difficult to implement. But that idea that, guideline development is both hard science and dark art, I think, was one of my themes today.
So I'm going to ask you a question about the makeup of those guidelines committees and your views on that. This is quite a long question because I need to fill in a little story first. So I published a blog by Clive Adams four years ago about CBT for psychosis.
Yeah.
And he was blogging about the sign guidance and the NICE guidance and the different makeup of those guidelines committees and the fact that the NICE guidance recommended CBT for psychosis and the sign guidance didn't. And that was a very big controversy at the time. But the NICE guideline committee had a lot of psychologists on it, and the sign committee had a lot of psychologists and a lot of psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. So how do you make sure that those kind of those committees are representative and actually come out with an unbiased, as unbiased a sort of recommendation as possible?
I think it's sometimes tricky because, of course, guideline committees are, you know, made up of the people who are on the committees, and people come from different disciplines, different backgrounds, different points of view. I mean, my understanding from NICE is that they try and get a broader constituency as possible. They pre-specify the kinds of people they might want on groups. There's always strong service user representation. And I mean, I think that's what it's about. I mean, inevitably, sometimes there will be, yeah, people might look at a guideline and think, oh, you know, look at the composition of this. They all favour one type of treatment or another. But as far as, you know, I think NICE are able, they look very carefully at the composition. But the other thing I'd say, you know, is the process. So the NICE process is really, I'd say, you know, it's amongst the most robust in the world. You know, and it's very, very detailed. You know, it's and I think that also, to me, kind of, you know, protects against some of the idea that, you know, this thing's biased. Oh, no guideline is perfect. I must say that. One of the things we need to think about is, you know, how we better implement guidance, but also how we better implement research. And one of the slides I put up was my H index. So some of your listeners might not know what H index is. For others, it will be one of the main motivating factors at work. I'm talking slightly flippantly. You know, in academia, we worry quite a lot about how much our research is used, how much it's cited. And the H index is a measure of how often your work is cited. So I put up my H index today to the amusement of many people in the audience, which shows that, you know, although some of my papers have been quoted, there's a long tail, and that means that probably about half my papers have been quoted once or not very much. And so that's quite an important lesson to us as researchers, that, you know, maybe half the papers we publish won't be cited very much. And my H index and my H graph, I don't think are particularly unusual. So then the question becomes, yeah, how can we get that research into practice more effectively? And dissemination is really important, you know, this kind of thing where we're trying to reach people who are out there, and, you know, they don't, people, policymakers might not want the academic papers, they're important. We publish lots of reports as part of the National Confidential Inquiry into Suicide and Safety. You know, they're well received. We record little video messages, so video summaries of some of our research. Again, they're reasonably well received, although sometimes quite painful to do when you know I'm recording a video of myself. But the thing people seem to like best of all are some of the infographics, and many people would be familiar with infographics. But, you know, the initially, when people talked about, you know, the idea of summarising, you know, 5 years of hard research in, you know, a single sheet with kind of brightly coloured kind of icons and graphics seemed a bit bizarre. But actually, it's the bit of our work that services use the most, service users value the most, and it's got lots of attention. I can't begin to take credit for that. That's the team back in Manchester who produce all this stuff.
How does that kind of work in terms of drilling down then? Because I guess that's an easy thing to share on social media. And, you know, here's the top line. But then when you kind of drill down, at what point do you give them the detailed report or the detailed paper?
So, I mean, we take a you know, multi-pronged approach to this. So everything is available. So, you know, you've got your infographic, you've got the video, we'll still do the videos, you've got, you know, summaries of what this might mean for your care, you've got the executive summary of the report, and then you've got the report. It's all there. you know, the raw data isn't quite there because it's a confidential inquiry for the confidential inquiry. So the raw data might not be there, but everything else is kind of out there. So you look at the top line, yeah, and that's a really, really interesting finding about people with drugs and alcohol misuse and suicide. I wonder, you know, what the finding is. And, you know, hopefully it's fairly easy to navigate. You go on our website, the report's all freely available. You can see the actual data. And you know, it's important for policymakers, clinicians, researchers to kind of make up their own mind. So is that a reasonable inference from the data? Have we drawn a reasonable conclusion? And I think that works. That combination of having everything available works really well.
Coming back to your point about H-index, I think it was nice that you were so self-effacing, but people in the audience weren't pointing and laughing. No. There was a kind of general collegiate sort of yes. response to that. But I'm interested in what you think about research impact and using that as a measure. Because actually, you know, in the digital world now, you know, we've got altmetrics and we've got other ways of measuring the numbers of people getting shared. But how do you think we need to develop digital and other means to actually be measuring true impact of research?
I think stuff like that is really exciting and potentially, you know, a really good kind of growth area about how we measure stuff. So, you know, the alternative just isn't, you know, some people say we can't have bibliometrics, it's all nonsense. And actually, but the alternative is, you know, us sitting around saying what we think about a paper and just giving it a kind of blind rating. There's a role for that, of course, but at least bibliometrics are objective. We all know, people will know how you can sometimes game bibliometrics. So if, you know, for example, I was to quote all my own papers all the time, that can inflate a bibliometric, that can inflate an H-index. But at least it's kind of objective. So we need to get smarter. And actually, you know, things, I'm a big fan of things like altmetrics. And, you know, and I'm particularly interested when there's a dissonance between, you know, maybe the number of times a paper has been quoted, but it's got a sky high altmetric score because it's been picked up by loads of media, it's been retweeted, and it's being used. And that for me is as valid a way of using the research as citing it. Both are important, and I think different things capture different aspects of it. But the idea that we need to get smarter is absolutely right, and it's all about how the research is used. And I think, you know, it's not, you know, when I started in research, it was all about journal articles. You know, we didn't care about anything else, and those days are long gone. And I don't want my research like that. I came into research, you know, I've got a clinical background. I came into research to actually, you know, try and again, maybe try and make a difference actually. And I think we've got to have research that's used. So that's my kind of challenge to all my friends and colleagues in the audience today.